John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Kathleen, we'll be back tomorrow. In our first hour this afternoon, we'll talk about how Big Tobacco has shifted its marketing targets to deal with the decreasing numbers of people who smoke. In 1960, smokers made up about 40% or more of the American population. That number is down to about 18%, and those who do smoke are smoking fewer cigarettes. In response to this overall decline in the number of people who smoke, the large tobacco companies are sharpening their marketing approach. Their new targets? The young, the poor, ethnic minorities, and the LGBT community. Some are calling these campaigns predatory. The tobacco companies, of course, beg to differ. Well, what do you think? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or find the Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. My guest this hour is Amber Bullock, Executive Vice President for Program Development at Legacy, an organization dedicated to reducing tobacco use. Amber is a veteran public health administrator and educator with more than 30 years of experience working with researchers, health professionals, clinicians, consumer groups, and community-based organizations. As Legacy's Executive Vice President of Program Development, she provides oversight for the Foundation's community technical and training programs and initiatives for priority population and youth. Amber Bullock, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Hello, John. Good afternoon to you and your viewers.
Well, let's start.
Listeners.
listeners. Well, yeah, I'm hoping there are no viewers because I have a radio face, so it's
okay.
Very well established. Well, let's start with some good news. I mentioned at the beginning that as a percentage of the population, smoking rates in the general population are down by more than half from where they were in the 1960s. Does that mean that the actual numbers of tobacco users are less, or are we just talking about a smaller percentage of the general population using tobacco products?
Well, the number of users in proportion are less than what they were in the 1960s. There's definitely been improvement and great news on that front. However, we do continue to have some challenges with particular groups and populations. And we know what works, but we also know that there is a long ways to go. So we're not quite, we don't have the issue solved by any means.
Well, but we have made progress. How has that progress been made? What's worked so far?
What has worked has been a number of different things. We've had national media campaigns, counter-marketing campaigns that have worked very well with youth, with teenagers, and with tobacco users. Legacy, along with the Centers for Disease Control, and now most lately the Food and Drug Administration that have authority over regulation of tobacco products, we all three have media campaigns that are targeted to various audiences, and we find that those campaigns do very, very well. We also know that clean indoor laws have had a tremendous impact on really changing the social norm. Used to be back in the day, you know, I'm a child of the 60s and 70s, and I can recall that, you know, tobacco was the norm. You know, my family smoked, my parents smoked, many of my peers did, and, you know, it wasn't unusual. That's what you went into in terms of public places and even private places. Things have really dramatically changed now. There are a lot more protections from secondhand smoke than we ever had in the past, and that's also great news.
Well, yeah, I mean, smoking was ubiquitous. My father was a four-pack-a-day smoker, and it wasn't until near the end of his life when my mother finally made him start going out to the garage to smoke so she didn't have to repaint the living room every year.
Yeah, and that's exactly the situation in my family. My father was a three-day-a-pack smoker, and unfortunately, he did succumb as a result of his tobacco use. And my mother, unfortunately, did when I was very, very young. I was a teenager when she died of a stroke. And that was due to tobacco use.
So it's not the norm anymore. We have indoor tobacco use laws in place. We aren't used to seeing people smoke in public places, restaurants, even bars in many states. You're not allowed to smoke indoors anymore. You don't see smoking in the workplace. You don't get it on airplanes or in buses. And people, even in their homes, they're, you know, it's where people would just light up and they expected to see an ashtray That's not part of the culture. So that's a part of it. What about the...
It is and it isn't. It is in the sense that you're right. There are protections that we have in public buildings. National federal buildings, for example, all have the same rules. But you're going to find variation when you go from locale to locale. And you do find that smoking and tobacco use is allowed in some parts of the country more than others. In the Midwest and the South, for example, compared to the West Coast or possibly the Northeast, there are variances and there are differences because many of these are state laws and or local laws. And so not everybody has gotten with the program yet.
And what about the role of taxation on tobacco use? Some states have really large tobacco taxes. Even some municipalities levy tobacco taxes. Other states, again, as you point out, with where you can smoke kind of regulation, taxation is kind of all over the board. But how has making cigarettes, for example, cost a lot more, impacted their use?
It definitely has been proven time and time again through scientific studies and evidence-based studies that when you raise the taxes, the consumption of tobacco products generally goes down. For some individuals, it's a sort of their aha moment. You know, it's costing me too much. It's time for me to really give this a serious try, you know, in terms of quitting smoking. But once again, there is variation as to what those taxes are and how much impact they have. For example, in a state such as Virginia, their cigarette tobacco tax is very, very low compared to some places that you might find in Alaska even, and, you know, New York and a number of other places, including your state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I mean, in some places we can be talking the total price for a pack of cigarettes could be, what, $10?
Yes, it can be in some locales. Yes.
So, just to give you an idea of how old I am, and during my very, very brief flirtation with cigarettes, I paid 35 cents for the only pack I ever bought. So that kind of tells you where I am.
That sounds like my experience. I think it cost 75 cents back in my day back in California, and quite frankly, that was very price sensitive for me. So I was a very limited tobacco user.
Yeah, I tried it for about a week, and I decided, well, you know, that's one thing I probably won't imitate Dad on, and that was that. But so we've seen changes in laws, again, a lot of variations depending on state and locality. Same thing with raising the price of tobacco use by taxing it. Some other changes that have happened over time, we don't see tobacco advertising on radio and television. In fact, a lot of people who are alive today have never seen a television ad for cigarettes or heard one on the radio because that ban has been in effect for so long. Did that contribute to our reduction in the use of cigarettes?
I think there's a combination of factors that contributed, some of which we just talked about. But keep in mind that where you live determines in large part how healthy a community is going to be with respect to a lot of different issues, including tobacco use. Tobacco, as we call it, is not an equal opportunity killer. And so when you look in some neighborhoods and you see that there are many more advertisements and promotions and posters and billboards, there are some storefronts that you'll even see inside the store in terms of the windows because there's ads, tobacco ads, all over them. And you particularly find this in low-income communities. So there is quite a disparity, you know, and what we consider to be an unequal distribution of what we consider to be what we call the social determinants of health. And that ties into educational attainment. It ties into income. But what we find in various communities is that there are folks who are struggling with quitting. There's a higher chance for them being exposed to secondhand smoke, and there's less access to services to help them quit.
Mm-hmm. And so these are the new target markets for the big tobacco companies. Then the poor, ethnic minorities, youth, the LGBT community. These are the new targets.
I wouldn't call them the new targets. They've actually been targeted for many, many years. It's just that some of the marketing that is occurring now has gotten much more sophisticated and much more intentional. And we also have, when we look at the entire landscape of tobacco products, we're not just talking about cigarettes here. You know, we're talking about lots of emerging products, Little cigars and cigarillos, for example, those are the small cigars. And little cigars actually, in many instances, look just like cigarettes. They just have brown wrapping around them. These are available in many, many flavors. Many of them are fruit-like, candy-like, bubble gum, you name it, it's out there. I once heard a quote of a convenience store or retailer saying, you know, we love these products because every quarter there's some new flavors that we can, you know, entice our customers with. Menthol products are also still unregulated. So there's a lot of unregulation going on with respect to these particular products in terms of what they can do. And what you're starting to see, look at the e-cigarettes, for example, you are starting to see ads on TV, which is something, as you mentioned earlier, you don't see for cigarettes because it is outlawed.
Well,
it is regulated.
I want to come back to that just a moment. But in terms of flavored, you were talking about flavored cigars. They're not regulated the same as cigarettes because except for menthol, flavored cigarettes were banned by the FDA, weren't they, in, 2009?
Yes, they were. The cigarettes were. But what is not under regulation currently are little cigars, cigarillos, e-cigarettes, for example.
Okay.
Hookah. You can even find all kinds of flavors in hookah, too.
Oh, my. Okay, let's talk about e-cigarettes. How are e-cigarettes different in terms of how they operate and what the health risks are from the traditional kind that we're used to seeing?
You know, e-cigarettes are devices that basically warm a nicotine solution that produces an aerosol that's inhaled without the combustion of tobacco. They vary in size and cost and efficiency in terms of their delivery. The most common are designed to look like cigarettes, and they are designed to mimic the act of smoking. So they're cigarette-like devices, and they are widely available. Some are disposable. Many of them are rechargeable using a cartridge for a nicotine solution. There are even personal vaporizers that are larger. They're more expensive, and they have refillable tanks for nicotine solution. They call it the e-juice.
So basically, this is a drug delivery device.
Yes.
And nicotine is a legal drug.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And I guess that is something that has perplexed a lot of people. One of the arguments against cigarettes was that they were a drug delivery device, something which the tobacco companies fought. But, I mean, e-cigarettes, I mean, the beard is off here. Basically, this is a device to deliver nicotine, which, according to people who have tried to stop using it, is one of the most difficult addictions to break. My own father, who in addition to being a four-pack-a-day smoker, was an alcoholic, and after he sobered up and gave up cigarettes, he told me that there wasn't a day that went by that he didn't crave a drink, but there wasn't an hour that went by that he didn't crave a cigarette. And so we really haven't had much luck regulating nicotine as a drug, have we?
Not as it currently stands. The cigarettes are regulated now via the FDA. So there are some standards that are being considered. And one of the things they did early on, like you mentioned earlier, was to get rid of those flavored cigarettes.
We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We have some callers who want to join us. If you're a smoker, how did you get started? I'd be interested to hear that. What was the effect of, was there some advertising? Were friends of yours smoking? And then if you've tried to quit, how has that worked for you? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also join us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Leave your comment or question there. You can also send an email. The address is talk@wpr.org. My guest is Amber Bullock, Executive Vice President for Program Development at Legacy, an organization dedicated to reducing tobacco use. And when we come back, Amber, I'd like to spend some time talking about how the advertising target, you talked about the shifting demographic of tobacco use. We talked about some of the products people are using and that menthol cigarettes are pretty popular these days. I'd like to talk about how tobacco companies are marketing and what the effect of that marketing is on those populations which seem to be the biggest users of tobacco. We'll do that. We'll also take your calls when we come back in just a moment. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about tobacco use in the United States. The good news is the overall percentage of people who use tobacco is considerably reduced from what it was back in the 1960s, but more work needs to be done, says my guest, Amber Bullock, Executive Vice President for Program Development at Legacy, an organization dedicated to reducing tobacco use. Well, Amber, we've been talking about we've been setting the table for the rest of the discussion so far. The tobacco companies obviously have a product they want to sell, and they're looking for people who will buy it, and they have a lot of money to spend. They spend about $8 or $9 billion a year advertising tobacco products. They're not doing it on radio and television. You talked about stores in low-income areas in the United States having their windows covered with signs advertising tobacco. There's an awful lot of what's called point-of-purchase advertising for tobacco products. Where else are tobacco products advertised, and how are these campaigns working?
Well, I mentioned the outside of the store, so let's go inside the store now. And if you've ever been in a convenience store or a place that sells a lot of tobacco products, they often have what they call power walls. And these are walls that are clearly at eye level, not only for adults, but also at eye level for kids also. And sometimes you will find some products like little cigars and cigarillos, for example, that are mixed in because of all the different candy flavors are mixed in with other products, other candy. And so it's hard to distinguish if you're a kid and, you know, you're looking over the counter or try to look over the counter. You don't have to look very far because it's right around you. And so that upfront marketing and that placement is very, very pervasive in many communities. So we call that eye level is buy level, like BUY level.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead.
And the Internet is also playing a huge role in terms of what you see in terms of advertising, not only the products themselves, but also individuals who use the products and acclaim, you know, just how fantastic they are. And you know, particularly when you've got young people who are doing that, and those who are influencers of young people, whether that might be folks that they look up to, peers, celebrities, and you have all that going on, that's also sending a lot of messages in terms of, hey, this is the norm. This is what you should be doing.
What do we know about how youth are responding to the anti-smoking message? I mean, we've had several decades of directed advertising that is educational in nature, advocacy in nature, in terms of trying to convince people to not use tobacco, whether it's cigarettes or chewing tobacco or whatever. What do we know about how those campaigns have been working to reduce smoking among youth?
They've definitely had nationwide, they've had an impact in terms of reducing the use of cigarettes. Right now there's roughly, in terms of usage of cigarettes alone, about 18%, roughly, give or take. And in your state of Wisconsin, it's a little bit less, which is really great news. It's about 14.5%. However, with those other products I was talking about, we're starting to see an upward trend and of use of those particular products. In your state, we've noted that little cigars and cigarillos are used by 15%. And years ago, this number was very small. It was in the single digit, and it's actually on the rise. And we're noting the same thing across the country also.
Hmm. And
so if you still look at nationwide, just the number of youth that are still continue to smoke, both middle and high school, you're talking about 3 million young people.
And what's the average age at which these young people start using tobacco products?
Uptake, it was up until recently. Uptake was, if you had not uptake by the age of 18, there was a very good likelihood that you would not uptake in the later years. That age is also starting to change, and it's starting to go upwards now. And so what we're also concerned about is young adults, and not just the teenagers any longer, but those mm-hmm. between 18 to 21, 22, because we're starting to see the numbers skewing in terms of the uptake And that's really big cause for concern.
All right. Well, you know what? We have full phones, as I expected we would. So let's take some callers. We'll start with Stephen in Bayfield. Stephen, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good afternoon. Answering your question about why I started using tobacco, I started using chewing tobacco in middle school, and I was a baseball player, and the big league players chewed tobacco. For about 10 years, I had a dental issue, and I switched from chewing tobacco to smoking cigarettes. And in addition, I also worked in college for a tobacco company in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The Joel Camel ad campaign, which has now been banned. And I'm still addicted. I'm 47, so I've been smoking for 20 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I just wanted to weigh in on your question about why I found tobacco. And I guess it was initially you got a buzz from it when you were a kid, you know, in middle school. And my heroes chewed tobacco. So that's about all I have to weigh in on.
All right. Stephen, thanks for the call. Amber, Stephen's story, probably typical for a lot of people. They saw big leaguers using chewing tobacco. It was a tradition for many years in dugouts in Major League Baseball. Not so much anymore. They're chewing sunflower seeds and shredded bubble gum that comes in a package that looks like chewing tobacco. But people look at those they admire and they want to be like them. Do we still see some of that going on?
Most definitely, as I mentioned earlier, celebrities have a great influence, particularly on young people. Everyone wants to be kind of part of something, you know, and they often will emulate who they admire. And so what Stephen has shared with us is very typical. I actually have in my own personal situation a brother-in-law I never actually met. I've been married now for 5 years, and prior to meeting my husband, his brother died suddenly of a heart attack, age 53, had taken up tobacco use also at a very young age of 13. So I can definitely empathize, you know, the reasons behind, and I hope that Stephen, at some point, you'll be able to, be able to quit and give it a really good try. I hope you're able to do that.
And there are many states have fairly elaborate support networks to help people get off cigarette. But again, is that something that varies a lot from state to state, or is there some standardization across the country there?
Well, there's standardization on a number of fronts. We talk about helping individuals or providing resources for those who want to quit smoking. There are three things that we know that really works well. One is use of nicotine replacement therapy and or prescription drugs to really help with to deal with the physical addiction side of tobacco use. But tobacco use is very complex. It's not just about a physical challenge. It's also behavioral, and it's also your emotional support that you have or you don't have. So dealing with and getting the appropriate level of help, and one of the good news things is the fact that there is a 1-800-QUIT-NOW number, which can provide counseling and help. Telephone, it's free. If you call anywhere in the country, you will get hooked into your state quit line or help line, and it's there for you, and it's a really great resource. And they also know what some of the local resources are, which are more important, because for some individuals, they do better with having one-on-one support or group support. And we also have a legacy of a online system for those who want to do it on the internet. So that's another aspect of it too.
And as our culture has changed, I mean, smoking, as we talked about earlier in the program, has been gone from being ubiquitous to in many parts of the country being the exception. There's a certain There's been maybe a change in public opinion about smoking. Some people are pretty vocal in opposing it. In fact, we've got a story from a caller, Mike, in Madison. Let's take that call next because Mike's got an interesting story to tell. Mike, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks. Yeah, so basically my story is I'm a smoker, and I preface this by realizing that I know smoking is terribly bad and unhealthy, but something I do enjoy, just like caffeine and sugar and the other things that are bad for me as well. But so the story is I was sitting at an intersection. I'm a smoker. I was smoking in my truck. I had my window down. The car next to me was sitting there with her window down, and the smoke had wafted over into her car, and she honked and she hollered at me, and she said, you know, I can smell your cigarette. You're giving me cancer. And so I put my foot on the gas pedal, and I revved the engine a couple times, and I said, well, that's 10,000 cigarettes right there, but you can't smell it or see it. So, and then I told her, I said, do you realize if you lock 10 people in a garage for 24 hours, 10 chain smokers in a garage for 24 hours, sealed up tight, they might leave with a sore throat. Now, if you lock one person in a car, in a garage with a running car for 45 minutes, they're dead. And we don't seem to have much of an issue about burning tons and tons and tons of fossil fuels and gasoline and petrochemicals and all the other stuff out there. But for some reason, cigarettes really seems to be this insane point of contention among the U.S. and only in the U.S.
Okay. Mike, thanks a lot for the story. Mike makes a number of points there. If you'd care to address them, Amber, that'd be great.
Sure. Now, secondhand smoke is dangerous. It may not appear on the surface to cause much harm, but there is unrefuted scientific evidence that it does cause harm to a number of individuals. And it's not just what is occurring here in the U.S. There are other countries, particularly in Europe, for example, that have also banned cigarette use and combustible product use within, you know, public settings and restaurants and bars. So as we've learned more and more, and the Surgeon General's report is very clear about what these risks and what these dangers are, it's not just an annoyance. It's not that simple, but it definitely is. It is harmful. And it's not just regulations and rules that are occurring within this country.
Sure.
It's recognition worldwide of what's going, you know, what's going on with this issue.
What about? I mean, Mike made a kind of a passing comparison between cigarettes and other really unhealthy things that a lot of us do. We don't get enough exercise. We eat a lot of the wrong food. There are additives in our food that can cause cancer, things like that. And I think he's suggesting is, hey, I just happen to use cigarettes. What's the big deal?
Well, we know tobacco use to be the number one preventable cause of death and disability. It's up there at the top. If you look at any statistics, whether they be local or national, and you look at folks that could have been around for a much longer time, if it hadn't been for certain things, tobacco's right at the top of that list.
Mm-hmm. The number to call to join the program, we do have lines available if you want to call right now, is 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, and you can also join the Kathleen Dunn program on Facebook. John Munson in for Kathleen today. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. She's got the day off. And we'd welcome your participation in the program at 800-642-1234. Let's take a call from Steve in Milwaukee. Steve, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just calling about the difference. Pipe tobacco. I'm actually a smoker of pipe tobacco. I was cigarette tobacco at one time. But anyway, pipe tobacco's got the same cut, and you put about three or four blends tobacco, and it tastes just like a cigarette, and it smokes just like a cigarette, and it's only a 1/4 the price. So what's going on there?
Interesting question, Steve. Amber, what is the difference between the tobacco you put in your pipe and cigarettes? Are they taxed differently, or what would account for disparity in cost?
In many locales, they are taxed differently. Typically, roll your own tobacco or pipe tobacco, smokeless tobacco are taxed at a much lower level than what you find with the price of cigarettes.
I had a brief flirtation with smoking a pipe and rimless glasses. I thought they both made me look more intellectual, and then I burned holes in two of my favorite sweaters and threw the pipe away. So that's my smoking story. Steve, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Mary in Milwaukee. Mary, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I wish the tobacco industry would go into a whole different direction, into animal feed. I mean, they could use the tobacco leaves for feed, and horses love it, and I know hay is becoming a premium, and I think that would be a whole different direction for them, minus the nicotine, of course. And maybe they could start concentrating on people and start concentrating on animal feed.
Animal feed. Amber, do you think that would be an appropriate use for tobacco?
I don't have a particular comment on that, but okay. One thing I will share with you, however, is down in many of the traditional states that have been known as tobacco-growing states, North Carolina, for example, Kentucky, Maryland, many years ago, many of the farmers started to grow other types of crops, soybeans, and other products, and part of it was because they were not being treated fairly by the tobacco companies in terms of their prices, and so they have diverted, and they have found success in diverting to these other, growing these other tobacco, non-tobacco products. So it can be done. I just don't know specifically to Mary's question about.
I know that that tobacco, as part of the our nation's agriculture, has in the past been fairly heavily subsidized, just like a lot of other cash crops are. There are programs for that. Are we still subsidizing tobacco production with tax money?
I don't know the answer to that one.
Okay. Well, I bet somebody in our audience does, or one of my crack producing team can dig that information up for us. I do know that was an issue at one time. We were banning cigarette ads on television, but we were still paying people to grow tobacco, and it always seemed like a little bit of a conundrum to me, at any rate. 800-642-1234. Boy, this is our afternoon for Steve's. We've got Steve in Sheboygan on the phone with us. Let's go to Steve next. Steve, good afternoon.
I guess you're right. Maybe we should get the trifecta or something going, you know?
There you go.
The comment that I have is, you know, I've worked in bars and stuff like that. And the thing that I see kind of funny is, for all the hundreds of years that the smokers had all their rights, when us non-smokers now have our rights, they don't accept that. But we had to accept their smoking wherever we went, smelling however we did, secondhand smoke, et cetera, et cetera. And now that the shoe is on the other foot, they don't want to accept it. But we had to accept them for hundreds of years for them to do whatever they wanted.
Steve, thanks for the call. An example of how attitudes are changing toward particularly smoking, but probably other types of tobacco use as well, not as popular as it once was. But there does seem to be kind of a debate, smokers insisting they have the right to use their cigarettes and other devices wherever they like, and others saying, hey, we don't want that where we're going to have to be. And I guess depending on where you are in the country, Amber, it plays out a little differently.
Yes, it does. And I think one of the distinctions we need to make here is that the work that we do at Legacy, we are not against smokers. We recognize that tobacco use in many, many cases is truly an addiction. And so we do have empathy, and we do understand the struggles that many have. A lot of tobacco users want to quit, approximately 70% of them. The reality is that it's not easy to do so. It takes often repeated tries. Our studies show that it can take as many as 8 to 11 on average attempts before you're successful. And just as you were saying earlier, John, there's a situation where even when you do quit, it doesn't mean that the feeling doesn't go away. It didn't for my father. He had the same situation in terms of there wasn't a day that went by that he did not want to smoke. And this is after having 3 heart attacks and quadruple bypass surgery. So he had quit, but it was not an easy thing for him, and it isn't for many individuals.
We did get some information about whether or not we're still paying people to grow tobacco. Apparently, what we are in is a transition period where tobacco growers who have received payments through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Tobacco Transition Payment Program are being more or less paid now to kind of transition out of that if they want. It's a commonly known program now as the Tobacco Buyout Program. And that is still in existence. It was established in 2005. And tobacco, direct subsidies for the growth of tobacco have ended. And so now we're in the process of kind of helping people who have been growing tobacco transition out of it. I guess that begs the question, which I'll ask when we come back, because we really need to get to a break, Amber. And that is, where's the tobacco coming from now? If we're not growing it, if we're going to stop growing it, or at least paying people to grow it in the U.S., are we importing our tobacco? And if so, where does that come from? And then also, before the end of the program, want to get to some of the targeted populations for cigarette marketing and how that's working and how the whole menthol thing plays into that, because that is a very popular form of cigarette, particularly with certain ethnic groups. Want to talk about that as well. A lot more to come. So stick around. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about tobacco use today on the Kathleen Dunn program, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we're talking about the use of cigarettes, tobacco use, or the use of tobacco in the United States. Tobacco use is down considerably from where it was in the 1960s. More work needs to be done, says my guest, Amber Bullock, Executive Vice President for Program Development at Legacy, an organization dedicated to helping reduce tobacco use and helping people get off tobacco. So if we're not subsidizing farmers to grow tobacco anymore and we're paying them to transition into other crops, the assumption I would make is that we're growing less tobacco in the United States. And I don't know if you know that much about it, that or not. But if we stopped growing tobacco in the U.S., I'm not saying we will or won't, is tobacco a big cash crop in other parts of the world, you know?
Yes, it is. Now, the work that Legacy does, by the way that we were formed as an organization under the Master Settlement Agreement, we only do domestic work. We don't really do international work, so we're less on top of what's going on all over the world. But I can tell you that when you look at the growing markets for tobacco use, you do find Eastern European countries, China, Africa, and in some cases, some of these countries do grow tobacco for the tobacco companies here, and they do import in, the tobacco itself.
Mm-hmm.
So there's less of a reliance on domestic and more of a reliance on imports.
So, okay, so let's talk about who's using tobacco. And we did talk about tobacco advertising, point-of-purchase advertising, particularly in poorer neighborhoods. I want to talk about menthol cigarettes, because that's become a really big deal. In fact, it was at least in part the reason for the acquisition of one major tobacco company by another to create an even bigger tobacco company. And one of the pieces that was created was access to a bigger market share for menthol cigarettes. Who are the major users of menthol cigarettes in the United States, and why is that?
African-American tobacco users, by and large, 70 to 80% utilize menthol over non-mentholated products. And what we're also noticing, however, is in terms of youth uptake, we're noticing with other ethnic groups more of a use of menthol products. For when you first start learning how to smoke, menthol is much more soothing. It's less harsh in terms of use of the product, whether it be with cigarettes or be with little cigars and cigarillos or whatever. So, but by and large, it's ethnic, populations and African Americans.
Let's take another call quickly. Let's go to Joe in Pleasant Lake. Joe, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm just wondering if your guest, I have no scientific data to back this up, but I have a real strong speculation that the sales of flavored cigarillos, flavored cigars, and also the blatant blunt wraps, those sales have increased due to the large use of them being used to roll marijuana cigarettes, as opposed to people just actually smoking those products for their tobacco. It's actually a product I wanted to develop about 10 years ago as I was importing cigars, and I had direct access to Connecticut shade-grown wrappers. But I'm just wondering if Legacy Hemp Group has any data on that.
Joe, thanks for the call. Amber?
Do I have Pacific data right with me at the moment? No, I do not. But in terms of the all the emerging flavors and the use of the flavors, both in the wraps and in terms of the products themselves, yes, they are on the increase. We know that the advent of all the flavors has definitely kicked up the profits and sales for the tobacco companies. Menthol, if you look just at the menthol flavors alone in tobacco products and specifically in cigarettes, they account for 25 to 30% of the profits. So that is, it's a big moneymaker for them. Not something that they readily want to give up either.
Thanks for the call, Joe. There was one of the pieces that I was reading preparing for this program quoted an issue brief from the Center for American Progress, which suggested that tobacco companies were engaging in what they called predatory marketing against the LGBT community through the sale of menthol flavored cigarettes. And I was wondering if you could comment on that at all.
The tobacco companies are very savvy at really being able to hone in on the precise messaging that's going to appeal to different population groups, including the LGBT community. So, yes, they co-opt their images. They co-opt their events. They will also sponsor many of their cultural events and, you know, many of their parades and so on, and to really buy favor, you know, for introducing their products. So when they talk about predatory marketing, these are just part of the bag of tricks, I guess you could call it, to get favor in a number of different communities, including the LGBT community. So I would agree with their assessment in terms of predatory marketing. It's very select, it's very targeted, and it's there for one purpose, and that is to get new customers and new replacement customers.
And are they being successful with that? Do we see increasing rates of smoking in that community?
The rates of use in the LGBT community is relatively high. I've seen as high as 50%.
Okay. Let's try and get some more calls in before we get to the end of the hour here. Mary in Fort Atkinson, you'll be next.
Oh, hello. Yes, this is a little past what you're talking about, but I just wanted to comment about the last Steve's call regarding smokers and their attitudes. And I have to say, as a smoker for 45 years, I've tried to quit at least a half a dozen times. I'll try to keep quitting. But I know many smokers, including myself, who do not have that attitude. I am glad that the state has in place the regulations that there's no longer smoking in public places like restaurants and taverns or parks and so on, because I feel that we do not have the right to force our secondhand smoke on others. And it's also a health issue, and I realize that. And I try to be considerate of others. If I'm hanging out with people who are non-smokers, I usually ask them, do they mind if I smoke? If I have non-smokers in my vehicle, I will not smoke. So I just want to let people out there know that not all smokers are that inconsiderate.
All right, Mary, thanks for the call. Amber?
Thank you, Mary, for saying that. And you know, another thing, because in my family, there are individuals who still continue to smoke. And I have found by and large, not just because of what I do, they are very considerate. And the other thing that most of them, if not all of them, have told me is that they realize that they are dealing with something that they may not feel that they can change, even when they've tried, but they do not want their kids to smoke. They do not want other family member youth, and they do not want that uptake to happen. They don't want to see that happen in the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Let's take another call this time. Dave in Oshkosh. Dave, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a comment, and this is coming from a smoker's perspective, but I think the anti-smoking campaign on a whole has gotten completely out of hand. I understand where with secondhand smoke that the federal government and state governments don't want smoking on their properties and public transportation, But ultimately, this is not a nanny state. You should not be protecting me from myself. If it's up to the private owner's establishment whether or not they want smoking in there, that's how it should be done. They cannot protect us from ourselves. That's not their job. And the overall taxation of it, it's gotten absolutely insane. As you referenced before, you're paying $10 a pack in some states. That is daylight robbery. We've fought wars over less.
Okay. Dave, thanks for the call. Amber?
I don't necessarily agree with you, Dave. I understand where you're coming from. But when you look at a number of different variables here, when you talk about private businesses, for example, there are individuals who, if smoking is allowed in those places, that are working there, and their health is being compromised. And so that's not fair, and that's not right. If you look at just what the cost associated with tobacco disease and disability down the line, somebody's got to pay for that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just two things that I would point out. But I respect your opinion, Dave.
Let's see. Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Jocelyn, good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon, John. You should have your own show, by the way. I just wanted to say that I quit cold turkey in 1989 on New Year's Eve. And what really convinced me was C.F. Recoup, our Surgeon General at the time, who had the integrity to say how dangerous it was, like cocaine or heroin, and smoking itself was, you know, when you take it in as by smoke, it's even worse. And also I watched on C-SPAN all the CEOs under oath saying that nicotine was not addictive. It was just, that was the end for me. And I started smoking when it was 25 cents a pack out of the machine. I remember that. I stole cigarettes from my mom. So, and I quit then, and I had a dream that I was smoking. It was such a real dream. But that was the only real thing that I went through, you know, where it was hard. I was very busy for about a month, but I did it, and I'm glad I did.
And you were successful, and you're still not smoking. Congratulations. Good job, Jocelyn, and thanks for your call. Amber, C. Everett Koop, a lot of influence. We talked about the influence of the people maybe who use tobacco on those who might use it. How about the influence of opinion leaders who have been opposed to tobacco use? How has that worked?
In terms of Dr. Koop, I mean, his contributions were immeasurable, and we continue to have surgeon generals who release reports that come up with more and more evidence, scientific evidence, in terms of all the harm that's caused by it. And I think for some individuals, when you look at what health providers say, such as individuals like these, it makes a big impact. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily have to just be these individuals. If you just take a look at also folks that are influencers in your own life in terms of what they're doing and what they're standing up for, that can have also an impact. The triggers for each of us is a little bit different in terms of what it takes to say, okay, I've had enough. I really need to make a big change here.
Mm-hmm.
I do applaud Jocelyn for being able to quit cold turkey. Typically, it doesn't work that well for most individuals. Unfortunately, the percentage of those who are able to quit cold turkey is 3 or 4%. It's very small. But saying that, she also quit a number of years ago. There are many more additives that are in tobacco products now that really kick up the nicotine kick and the yield, per se. And so that has an influence also.
We've got about a minute left here. How can people find out more about Legacy?
Well, you're welcome to go on our website, which is AmericanLegacy.org, and we have all types of information on resources, fact sheets, resources for quitting, information about our youth prevention programs, and our counter-marketing campaigns also. And so there's a wealth of information on there. Also, a number of our policy statements on a number of issues related to even electronic cigarettes, for example.
Okay. Amber, thank you so much for spending this informative hour with us. I really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you very much for having us, and we appreciate it, and I hope that your listeners have benefited from the information.
I am certain that they have. Amber Bullock is a veteran public health administrator and educator with more than 30 years of experience working in this field. She is Executive Vice President of Program Development for Legacy. This program was produced by K.P. Whaley, on-air production by Michelle Good and Dave Potratz, and I'm grateful to both of them. Next hour, we're going to talk about the progressive movement, which has its roots in Wisconsin. We'll find out about what happened when it was born. And, of course, fighting Bob La Follette, Teddy Roosevelt, a lot of stars. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network.